Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Pollutants have been showing up in water wells in the Pinedale Anticline gas field since 2006. Until recently, no one knew where the contamination was coming from. Now, the Bureau of Land Management and the Department of Environmental Quality have released a report indicating that most of the problem was not caused by energy production. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
The investigation found that a lot of the contamination occurred naturally. Basically, underground gas worked its way up through the geologic layers and into the groundwater. The report says other pollutants came from materials used in installing water wells. Kelly Bott represents Ultra, Shell, and QEP, three of the energy companies operating in the Pinedale Anticline. She says the study shows that operators are doing things right.
We've got a number of industrial practices that are in place to protect groundwater, and this study really validates those practices.
There were a few exceptions in the findings. In one instance, contamination could be traced back to an abandoned gas well, and a handful of water wells lacked the equipment necessary to ensure that contaminants from, say, storage tanks don't get into the water. But industry standards have been revised to deal with many of these issues. Mary Gamper with the BLM says there's more good news. They've determined that groundwater in the area moves very slowly. Gamper says that means contamination also moves slowly.
Should a contaminant be released in like 100 years, that contaminant likely would not move greater than 150 feet. So we wouldn't expect, you know, a 5-mile by 30-mile long contamination plume, except if every single well on the Anticline was leaking.
The company that compiled the report concluded that no additional mitigation measures are necessary to deal with water problems in the Pinedale area.
It would still be a mistake to not pursue mitigation in the area.
Bruce Pendry is an attorney for the Wyoming Outdoor Council.
Oil and gas development uses a wide array of chemicals, some of them quite toxic, known carcinogens and that kind of thing. And so I think care, the precautionary principle, if you will, should continue to really guide mitigation efforts out there.
Mary Gamper says the BLM is proceeding with care.
There are some things that we need to look at a little closer. Things are good on the Pinedale Anticline. There's no question there, but it does not mean that they can't be better.
Gamper wants to do more field testing to be extra certain that no gas wells are leaking. And she wants to take a close look at things like well casings to make sure they go deep enough to protect usable groundwater. The BLM also plans to create a new monitoring and mitigation plan for the Pinedale Anticline. Gamper says that will help prevent future pollution and enable them to detect problems more effectively. Despite all that, some Pinedale residents feel regulators are not doing enough to protect groundwater. Linda Baker with the Upper Green River Alliance has seen a lot of changes in her area and some environmental damage related to energy development, so she's skeptical. She points out that although most of the contamination has been documented at very low levels, several wells had high levels of hydrocarbons.
And yet only approximately half were entered into the DEQ's Voluntary Remediation Program.
The Voluntary Remediation Program, or VRP, is meant to get companies to clean up contamination when it occurs at high levels, that is, levels exceeding state standards.
I don't understand why the DEQ hasn't entered all of those wells into the VRP program.
DEQ's Deborah Harris says there's a good reason. In some wells, high levels of contamination were detected only once, not in any follow-up sampling. She says when that's the case, there's a good chance that the one high reading was a fluke.
The laboratory analytical methods, you know, they're pretty good. But you have to remember that, you know, people are out in the field doing the sampling. Maybe their truck was running nearby. You know, and we all know that an automobile engine runs on hydrocarbons. So, you know, it could have been something as innocuous as that.
Harris says not to worry. If a well consistently shows high levels of contamination, remediation does happen. Always. And regulators say industry is taking steps to prevent future pollution. For example, they no longer use lubricants containing hydrocarbons when installing water wells. And they're required to use special equipment to prevent outside pollutants from entering wells. The BLM will consider instituting additional rules in its new monitoring and mitigation plan, though it's not clear when that plan will be finalized. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Wyoming's biggest export is soda ash. which comes from Trona mines in Sweetwater County. Last year, the Trona industry produced 17 million tons of soda ash, for which the state received nearly $90 billion in various taxes and royalties. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhuroff reports, the industry has a dirty side, too.
Wyoming is used to superlatives. The biggest coal bed, the largest mine, the most wind. Here's another.
The Sylvan Retreats of Wyoming, USA is home to the world's largest reserve of Trona.
The largest Trona deposit. That's a video from one of the companies that mine Trona. Aside from another small mine in California, the four facilities in southwestern Wyoming are the Trona industry in the U.S.
We now produce about 90% of all the soda ash used in the United States and about 25% of all the soda ash used in the world.
That's Marion Loomis, director of the Wyoming Mining Association.
About 85% of the value of what Wyoming exports out of the United States is soda ash.
Trona is used to produce sodium carbonate, which is used in everything from glass production, paper, and baking soda. But the industry that produces these innocuous everyday products is also a big polluter. It's one of the biggest emitters of volatile organic compounds and hazardous air pollutants among big sources in the state. Most of the facilities are also in the top 10 list of emitters for nitrogen oxides. Bruce Pendery lives in Utah but works for the Wyoming Outdoor Council and has made the drive through the Trona Patch in southwest Wyoming on his way to Cheyenne dozens of times.
You can see the plumes of smoke stretching out from the various plants and covering really quite a wide area.
He says the pollution he sees around the Trona plant seems worse than the coal-fired power plants he also passes. Pendery's observations are anecdotal, but on the day of my visit to the FMC Trona facility, the horizon was also heavy with dull gray columns. John Lucas is FMC's environmental team leader, and he navigated through the huge industrial site's many stacks.
Basically, what you're seeing is primarily water vapor. About 99% of our emissions at FMC are water vapor and some carbon dioxide. The other 1% of our emissions are methane from safely venting the mine, from natural occurring methane, and then other process-related emissions.
Those process-related emissions adhere to complicated permitting from the Department of Environmental Quality. DEQ says getting emissions down is a process. Lucas says one way it's done is the best available control technology, or BACT review, which is done when they modify or add operations.
They'll look around across the industry and find the best available control technology, and that's what they'll apply.
The idea is that as technology gets better, emissions will get lower. But there may be other holes. For example, there are also maximum achievable control technology, or MACT, standards that the EPA promulgates to control hazardous air pollutants for new and existing sources. But for the most part, the EPA never developed any MACT standards for the Trona industry. And remember that methane Lucas mentioned? Those industrial sites sit on top of huge mazes of very gassy underground mines. FMC's Fred Von Aaron says large volumes of air are moved around the mines to vent them of the methane.
The real goal of the ventilation in the mine is to move fresh air in and keep fresh breathing air in there for the miners.
The Mine Safety and Health Administration requires this. The dirty air carrying methane, volatile organic compounds, and hazardous air pollutants gets pumped up to the atmosphere through a vent.
The bulk of the VOCs and HAPs comes from the shales that are in the mine themselves.
In other words, those vents contribute pollution, but they're not controlled. Here's the DEQ's Cole Anderson.
It's important to note that air quality regulates sources that essentially from the ground level and up. We do not regulate mines or underground mines.
In past operating permits for the Trona companies, DEQ listed the mine vents as sources of emissions, but usually did not list how much they emit or any permits that apply to them. Still, VOC and HAP emissions are included in DEQ's inventory, but methane is not. Jeremy Nichols, Climate and Energy Program Director for Wild Earth Guardians, has been looking at the issue of methane emissions from coal mines. He says there are no specific regulations dealing with methane venting for mines, but the permits still strike him as odd.
It seems to me that Wyoming needs to be making sure these Trona mines are starting to report their emissions and ensure that they're being accounted for through their permits. I mean, they have to at least come clean and say, okay, from our ventilation system, this is how many tons per year of methane are being released.
There's another issue, too. If pollution is being pumped into the atmosphere and things like methane aren't even accounted for, how do nearby residents know their air is okay? That's usually done with monitoring. Kari Kessler works in DEQ's monitoring division.
The state doesn't have any monitors at the Trona facilities right now.
There hasn't been one in Green River within the last 10 years either. This spring, DEQ did install an ambient air monitor in Rock Springs, about 40 miles downwind of the facilities.
Actually, looking at the emissions, we were more concerned about oil and gas growth closer to Rock Springs than Trona.
Data from the monitor does not show any legal exceedances so far, but there have been short-term spikes in particulate concentrations. The Trona companies have monitors too, though they only monitor one pollutant, particulates. If it seems like the Trona industry is getting by with less regulations and checks than other industries, Nancy Veer, who represented the DEQ's Air Quality Division out of the Attorney General's office for a decade, says that's an illusion. She says Wyoming has solid regulations.
My understanding is that most of the Trona being mined in the United States is virtually all from Wyoming, and there's only several facilities that are doing it. So that may be why the federal government has not promulgated regulations specific to Trona. But that does not mean that Trona is going unregulated.
And FMC's Von Aaron says if you compare the whole Trona industry to the whole oil and gas industry, for example, Trona's emissions are much smaller. Plus, he says, Trona's just different.
The Trona itself is a very pure mineral. It's a pretty benign chemical.
That may be true, but producing that benign chemical can be dirty business. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
When we come back, we'll talk with State School Superintendent Cindy Hill. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. It's been a long year for State Superintendent Cindy Hill. After legislators determined that she was undermining some of their education reform efforts, they voted to take away her ability to run the State Department of Education and assigned her to less essential tasks. Later, a report suggested mistreatment of employees, possible misuse of the state aircraft, and misuse of Department of Education money. That last piece is being investigated by a legislative committee who is trying to determine if impeachment charges should be brought against Hill. For those who think Hill was incompetent, recent test scores show that students actually improved during her time running the Department of Education. Hill says her problem started when she objected to some federal initiatives.
Before I was elected, there was a race to the top application by the Wyoming Department of Education. And in that application, the Common Core, the National Assessment, the longitudinal data systems, so that blueprint was all laid out. Before I walked through the door, these things were on a train, if you will. That train was rocking and rolling. And I stepped in, and elected by the people of Wyoming, I said our standards should be Wyoming standards. And I feel still strongly about that. And I think that our assessment should come from Wyoming. It should represent our values. And this federalizing of education is very clear. It was happening before I came through the door. And those things were, I would say, on pause and interrupted as I came through the door. You know, one of the things I talked to Senator Enzi about when I first came through the door and when I first was sworn in, there was this waiver, which everyone thinks waiver sounds good, but what it was is waiver from No Child Left Behind, which actually had more federal requirements than No Child Left Behind. And I said, so I'm not applying, Senator, and he thought I was doing the right thing. I learned that there was a great deal of pressure not only for me to apply for it, but there was a great deal of anger when I didn't.
So your opposition to that got you crosswise, you think, with legislators and others?
Oh, absolutely. I think the people of Wyoming, and I'm not cross-eyed with the people of Wyoming. I'm doing exactly what they elected me to do.
State Superintendent Cindy Hill visiting with us. So right now where we're at is you've got a special legislative committee investigating you and some of the work that you did as superintendent when you were within the department. There have been some accusations. One of those is misspent money. It's been portrayed that, you know, when I think people read that charge, they thought you maybe have done something wrong with federal and state money. What's your position on that?
Well, I've heard Representative Lubnow say again and again there are well-documented allegations. I have sent him no less than five. I think it's more than five requests for those well-documented allegations. And there's not been any substance. I have not received one document, not one. So the due process that he spoke of, the transparency that the people deserve, it just hasn't been there. It has not been there. And it's been a huge disappointment because, like so many, I think we should trust our legislatures, And yet there's been a secretly held meetings, investigation after investigation, and still here we are wondering what specifically is, you know, is it that they're saying I misused? If someone would tell me what I specifically misused, it would be very helpful. And so we've been through the McPherson report or McPherson investigation and others, and yet we have nothing.
Do you think you're going to get impeached?
No.
Because they don't have the evidence? Would that be your opinion?
Well, actually, you don't have to have evidence to impeach. That's the, you know, when I sat before the investigative committee, I said, I'd rather have a prosecutor. I know what the facts are. I feel very confident. But when I looked at the committee, I said to Representative Kermit Brown, you might as well take the vote right now. Perhaps you have it. You could impeach me right now. You don't have to have any evidence. It's all political. They know it's political. I know it's political. I stepped in front of the federalizing of education train, and I'd step in front of it again. I think that's what the people elected me to do, do what was best for our kids, and that was focus on instruction and what really matters and making certain that the resources get to them. But instead, we're in this political, I don't know, this political game, if you will. I don't play games. I'm pretty straightforward. I'm honest. I'm going to tell you what's going on. And they could impeach me, but I don't believe that they will. I don't think the people will tolerate it.
How do you think this is going to end up? I mean, obviously, there's been bad feelings, you know, all around, and you've become a lightning rod for a lot of people. How does this end up, do you think?
Well, I don't see myself as a lightning rod. I see myself as someone who is standing up for the truth. And I think that a lot of times people haven't heard the truth. So I think once I'm on the other side of this, I'll be in a gubernatorial campaign, and you're going to hear more truth. We'll need to know about it.
What is the truth that we're all missing, do you think?
I think that we're a very wealthy state, and that some people have felt like they are entitled to direct the money where maybe the people would not have agreed it to have been directed. Some people have benefited by the wealth of this state. That's how you get a $4 million footnote to a bill for a senator's client. And that's how you get a field house in Casper for a legislator who happens to be a coach, and his team will be in that field house practicing. But no other district in this state will have a field house. How do those things work? Those are just a few. I could list many more. But what I've said to every legislator I've spoken with, I'm going the distance. I haven't misused any funds. In fact, my team referred it over $1 million to the people of Wyoming, returned it to the people of Wyoming from the Department of Education in the 2 years I was there. And I haven't broken a law or a policy, no violation of any policy. So I'm looking forward to having an opportunity when it is fair for me to speak. I haven't been given that opportunity. The meetings have been, again, secret and private. There's been no due process, even though it was promised. And I think the people deserve and will actually demand to know what's going on.
Superintendent Cindy Hill, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
More than half the U.S. population uses smartphones and apps, and as the appetite for mobile information continues to grow, some Wyoming entrepreneurs are poised to cash in for the sake of conversation. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Huntington has more.
When Story Clark gets into her Prius, she doesn't just start her engine. She also revs up a new mobile app that she's developed with her business partner, Maddie Kissick.
Hooking it up, it's Travel Stories GPS. The app is hands-free, and we're going to get going right now.
Do you have to tell it where you're going?
Yes. You can see the first screen to come up is your choice of tours.
Clark selects Highway 22 from the town of Jackson over Teton Pass. The app also allows her to customize her tour by selecting a channel based on her interests.
If you're interested in wildlife, you can learn about the wildlife along this route. If you're interested in history, you can learn about the history along the route. Just for Kids is the third channel, and it's great for those bored kids in the back seat of the car.
Clark picks local history, and as she drives toward Teton Pass, you can watch a little blue dot move along the map displayed on her smartphone. Small speech icons line the route, indicating places where a GPS location will trigger a story, like this one.
In 1911, 12-year-old Garrett Hardeman came to Jackson Hole after emigrating from the Netherlands.
And those stories come on automatically, hands-free.
Clark says there's a huge demand for GPS-triggered audio tours. Clark is the first to admit that she doesn't have a background in building tech startups or developing mobile apps. What's driving her new venture is her background in conservation. Clark runs a national consulting business that helps conservation groups nationwide raise money.
And the idea came to me when I was working with one of my clients, the Conservation Trust of North Carolina, and we were standing on the Blue Ridge Parkway. It's the most visited national park unit in the United States, and cars and motorcycles were whipping by. Nobody was stopping at the turnouts. Nobody was connecting with the amazing scenery, and certainly nobody knew that the Conservation Trust of North Carolina had anything to do with protecting the views.
Clark realized that if she wanted to make a difference, she'd have to get inside people's cars and inside their motorcycle helmets.
This is before GPS was even on phones. Let's see if we could get into people's cars, onto their phones, and tell them the stories that they were missing.
Conservation success stories like the one that preserved the picturesque Hardeman Ranch, where open space still graces a nearly century-old Gothic barn.
Picture the barn alive with animals and people and the bang of the auctioneer's gavel rising over the murmur of bids for the Hardeman's purebred Hereford cattle. The Jackson Hole Land Trust worked with the Hardemans and the community to protect the town's rural character and pastoral views. They
spearheaded a Herculean... As drivers enjoy the landscape, they can, with a few clicks of their smartphone or tablet, now make a direct $5 donation to the Land Trust.
I really felt there was a disconnect between tourists coming to a place, enjoying it, loving the beautiful scenery, and having no connection with the organizations that have worked so hard to conserve and continue to work hard to conserve the landscape that the tourists enjoy.
As Clark's company continues to fine-tune the app, the list of possible clients continues to grow. She's already getting lots of interest from college campuses, art galleries, and historical societies.
We're in conversations with the State Historic Preservation Office in Cheyenne to tell some of the amazing history stories around the state.
But there is a notable hurdle.
We need money.
The company is now shopping for investors to pay for hiring more staff and scaling up production. Clark wants to be poised to respond to an increasingly mobile marketplace, one where she expects consumers to turn away from computers in favor of mobile devices that can deliver information on the go. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
When we come back, we'll talk with Governor Matt Mead, and we'll hear about research that's being done into two different aspects of beetle kill. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Last week, Wyoming Governor Matt Mead released his proposed budget for the next 2 years. The governor joins us to discuss something he did not recommend and discusses other topics, such as whether he'll run for re-election. Your one budget decision that has seemed to get some criticism, at least in some of the things I've read, has been the decision not to propose going forward with the Medicaid expansion. I think we've heard you talk about that a number of times in the past. Will there be a time where you think that that might be an appropriate thing to do?
You know, it could be. I've tried to be as practical on that issue as I can. And again, you've heard me, you asked this question last week, and I want to repeat it. I think that the Department of Health, Director Forslund and his team and the insurance department have done an excellent job in trying to sort it out in terms of if we go forward, what is the best option? And I think that number three option, the Medicaid fit, is the best option if we go forward. So is there a time when I would be open to it? There is. But that would be a time when I'm convinced, number one, that is going to provide more health care to more citizens and continue to look at the issue on how we lower costs and provide high quality. As I see the rollout now on the exchange, while it is different in some ways than the expansion, it is all part of the same vehicle. I just don't have a degree of confidence that I can say to the legislature or the citizens of Wyoming, this is a good deal, and this is going to work well, and this is going to take care of our needs. So where I am on it is I recognize we have, you know, roughly 16,000 people that we need to address, you know, how they're going to get insurance, how they're going to get health care, more importantly. And this this is not the answer at this time based upon what I see.
I guess the frustration that I hear is that, okay, so you don't want to do this, you don't want to take federal money to do this, then what's the plan to deal with this population?
What I say to that is I don't think this is the right fix. I don't think this is going to get us where we want to go. And it's not just – it's not, hey, I don't want to take federal money. The fact is, as you know, through our budget, the state receives a lot of federal money from education, the Department of Health, Medicaid. That is not the crux of it. The crux of it is I'm not convinced that the expansion is going to work as they say it's going to work. The alternative, you know, what we do, you know, I supported Healthy Frontiers because I recognize that while I'm saying this isn't the answer, that we don't have a good alternative yet, but I don't think this is a good alternative. So I'm hoping that they will make changes to the ACA. I hope that they revise it or start over again and to get us to a point where we do have a solution that is workable for Wyoming.
Governor Matt Mead visiting with us. Governor, as we look ahead, I wanted to ask you about a particular agency and get your thoughts on this. We just sure noticed that not that anything's new here, but the Department of Environmental Quality has been involved in a number of things. There's work being done also by OSHA in our state to try and make things safe. There's a number of concerns out there. You've got Sinclair. You've got still issues in Pinedale, potential problems in Douglas. Are there thoughts or at least any discussion going on about maybe beefing up both of those agencies?
Yeah, you know, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago I asked for some extra positions at DEQ, and the legislature denied that in order for us to get out permits, in order to make sure that we're meeting what we need to in terms of making sure our environment is clean. You have to have a robust DEQ. Baseline water testing, that was DEQ was heavily involved in that and moving that forward. With regard to ozone, they continue to be very involved in that in terms of monitoring it. And you'll note that when the federal government shut down, that I had to make individual decisions on agencies. And one of the areas that I agreed to fund, even though it was a federally funded position, was the monitoring of the precursors for ozone, because that's something you just can't start and stop. So I think DEQ, they've got a lot of work to do. You know, in Douglas, when we saw the blowout of the well up there, you know, one of the things I recognize is the state needs to do a better job of responding to that. We now have a rapid response team so that when something like that happens, we get the right people up there to try to answer as many questions of citizens as possible. And on the safety side, you know, I think OSHA has, you know, obviously we put some more people into OSHA, some more people to both inspect and to provide information to companies. I think they too have ramped up their game. And so those things I think will continue to be on the table for us to work through. But I will say that I think both DEQ and OSHA are headed in the right direction.
Two last things for you. One, to ask you first about the university, obviously, with President Sternberg stepping down. You probably, no doubt, are aware that there had been some concern on campus among faculty and staff. Are you at all worried about anything going on at UW, or you think that's all going to sort itself out?
Well, I am worried about it. I think that, you know, I will say, I think President Sternberg, I liked his vision on, you know, how to make University of Wyoming the very best. But during that time period, I heard directly from a number of people who were concerned about, you know, how he was going about it. We certainly had feedback after the trustees made their decision on where they were going to go. So, yes, I am concerned about UW. I want to make sure that those hard decisions that were made, those are recognized by the trustees as the right decision. It's the, you know, how you go about it. So I think that Dick McGinnity is a very good person to be there right now. I knew him from my time at the Business Council. But I think everybody ought to be looking at UW and making sure we're on the right track. The trustees, I think, are working through that appropriately, and hopefully it will get us going in the right direction here in the near future.
And a great way to close, because I know you'll answer this question very openly and honestly, what are your plans for re-election right now? You've talked about maybe making an announcement in March. Could that potentially be too late if you decide not to run again?
That's a tough question for me to answer if that is too late. I think that as you look at historically, I remember when I made my run, I know Colin Simpson waited until after the session to make his official announcement, and I'm sure that was hard for him to wait that long, but he did that, and I think that it's appropriate. In terms of the decision, you know, over the holiday season, my family and I are going to be meeting and try to make a decision that we think works for us and, more importantly, is a good decision for the state.
So that final decision really has not been made in your mind?
That's right.
All right. Governor Matt Mead, thanks so much and happy holidays.
Thank you. Happy holidays to you, Bob.
Pine and spruce beetles have killed millions of trees across Wyoming and the West. Too many. The dying forests are visually unattractive, but there's a bigger issue. Researchers in the Medicine Bow National Forest are finding that beetle kill has had a major impact on how the forest processes carbon dioxide. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
It's quite a trek to get out to the Glacier Lakes Ecosystem Experiments site in the Snowy Range. A team of researchers drives a giant snowcat part of the way, then they switch to cross-country skis for the final stretch through the woods. The research station itself is tucked discreetly among the trees. There's a tall metal tower equipped with fancy instruments and a small building where computers record the data that's collected. Engineer John Frank built the tower, and he comes up every week to check the equipment. Today, the wind is blowing at more than 40 miles an hour as he climbs to the top of the tower.
A little breezy up there?
Oh my, that is terrible.
Frank says one of the key things they're measuring at this site is how much carbon dioxide the forest takes in and how much is released back into the atmosphere. Normally, forests absorb more carbon than they release. But Frank says beetle kill has changed that.
This forest went from a carbon sink to being actually a carbon source.
In other words, the forest now gives off more CO2 than it takes in. This is one of just a few locations in the world where scientists are documenting how beetle kill affects the carbon cycle. But Frank says his team was not particularly surprised by what they found.
We all knew that to have a good carbon sink going, you needed to have a good, healthy living forest.
And the Medicine Bow National Forest is not a healthy living forest. 80% of the trees are now dead, largely as a result of beetle kill.
It looks bad. It looks bad right now. And our sensors are telling us that effectively it is bad in terms of being a carbon source. That's not a good thing.
Not a good thing because extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere contributes to climate change. But Stephen Running, an ecologist at the University of Montana, says this is not the first time this has happened. Forests often become carbon sources when there's a disturbance, like a wildfire or logging. Still, he says this beetle kill epidemic is a little unusual.
I've had entomologists tell me it's the single biggest forest mortality event in the world. And so this is unprecedented in overall area.
Then again, not all forests are created equal, and Running says a major die-off in forests here in the Rockies is not especially disturbing on a global level.
Compared to the tropics, our arid temperate forests of the West, aren't very big sinks when they are a sink. They're not very big sources when they are a source. We really aren't a big player in the terrestrial carbon cycle.
And regardless, it's pretty likely that the trend will eventually reverse itself.
Eventually, we'll run out of trees, at least up here.
Bill Massman is the lead scientist at the Medicine Bow Research Site.
And so the beetles, at some point, will just simply run out of food, and the population will probably crash.
Massman says once the beetles die out, new trees will most likely grow, and the forest should go back to being a carbon sink. But nobody knows how long that will take.
This is a very harsh environment. Things grow very slowly up here. So I'm not sure that it'll be 5 years, 10 years, or 50 years.
In the meantime, as more trees die, the forest will likely absorb even less carbon dioxide. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
More than 40 million acres of trees have been killed by bark beetles in the Rocky Mountain West over the last two decades. Those trees are an eyesore, and as we heard in the last story, a source of carbon dioxide. But a new project is trying to find an upside to the epidemic. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has given researchers at five Western universities, including the University of Wyoming, $10 million to see if those dead trees can be converted into gasoline. The project has been hailed as a win-win-win for the atmosphere, the ecosystem, and the economy. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, skeptics question whether making gasoline is really the best use of the West's dead timber.
Demand for biofuels is huge in the U.S., in part because of a 2005 law that mandates the gradual stepping up of renewables in transportation fuels like gasoline. Most of that demand is met by ethanol from corn. But there are problems with ethanol, in part because it competes with food. Dead forests, on the other hand.
Can we utilize in a responsible way all that dead biomass?
That's Keith Postgen, the project lead and a professor at Colorado State University. He says if the trees were left to decompose, they would be net carbon emitters, whereas the conversion process to gasoline actually takes carbon out of the atmosphere. Or at least that's what the research team is counting on.
From my perspective, the number one reason for looking at biofuels is to reduce greenhouse gases that otherwise will be occurring from fossil fuel use.
They're hoping to do that using a unique process. They'll burn the wood in an oxygenless environment on site, turning it into gasoline. Then they'll take the byproduct of the process, charcoal, and add it to soils. Charcoal boosts plant productivity, which in turn pulls carbon out of the atmosphere, hence the negative carbon balance. Postgen says removing the trees is also a way to mitigate wildfires.
We desperately need in many areas to try to get that material out of the woods because it poses a hazard.
And there are potential economic benefits as well. The timber industry in the West has been declining for decades, but increased beetle kill logging could bring jobs back to communities. This project is just a test. Over the next 5 years, the researchers will study whether the benefits actually pan out and whether it's economically viable. But the technology's potential isn't lost on anyone, including Postgen.
If you look at the broader, really, the entire Rockies from Mexico all the way up through Canada into Alaska, there's obviously vast areas where they're going to be dealing with some of the same kinds of issues.
That kind of talk makes Greg Applett very nervous. He's the chief scientist for the Wilderness Society and an advisor to the project. He's skeptical that turning beetle kill into gasoline is such a win-win-win. To start, he worries about the scale.
What people who are skeptical of this enterprise fear most is this giant sucking sound of bioenergy that will create demand for materials that are far in excess of the ability of the ecosystem to sustain.
In other words, that just as we've done before, we may log too much. And he says the claim that logging beetle kill will prevent wildfires or reduce their intensity just isn't true.
We have 100 years of observing the impacts of mountain pine beetle in the West, and there's precious little evidence that the consequences of beetle attack is enhanced fire hazard.
Several recent studies, including one by NASA, support Applett's skepticism. But it's not just that the trees aren't a fire hazard. Applett says they actually contribute to a healthy forest.
Once heard some wag say, when a tree dies, its life is only half over. the role of a dead tree in an ecosystem continues on well past its death and even well past the time that it falls over on and starts decomposing into the forest floor.
For example, he says, when dead trees fall into streams, they provide important habitat and nutrients for fish. But Applett knows that his is the minority view. He says it's working against centuries of tradition to convince people that dead trees might be more valuable on the forest floor than in their gas tanks. But he's hopeful that as an advisor to the project, he can get the researchers' ear.
The kinds of questions that they are asking suggest to me that they're open to exploring those areas.
Which leaves open the possibility that in 5 years, we might find out that doing nothing is better than doing something. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
When we come back, we'll hear about a proposal to get more money for local governments. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. In the governor's budget last week, one area that didn't get a lot of attention is a proposal to increase funding to communities and counties by $175 million. That would be a $40 million increase over his previous proposal. 40% of that money would go for infrastructure, such as roads, but the rest would go into operations. If approved, it would come at a time when most local governments are dealing with less revenue. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Governor Matt Mead says he's trying to make local government funding a priority since he took office.
You know, the local funding is important because that is where our jobs are created. That's where people live. And if every community and every county is doing well, the state will continue to be strong.
By letting governments use money for operations, it allows them to pay for required services such as law enforcement. The governor says the infrastructure money is equally important.
We still have issues with roads, bridges, water, infrastructure regarding broadband, and I really see, in my view, the results of getting healthy funding back to local government. I think it pays big dividends for the state.
This is downtown Cody, Wyoming. Located near Yellowstone, Cody is clearly a tourist town. The city and Park County get a lot of their funding from sales tax, but with the downturn in the national economy in 2008, the county and city started seeing less revenue due to less tourists. Mayor Nancy Tia Brown says several years ago, the legislature removed the sales tax from food. She says initially they gave local governments money to make up for that loss in revenue, but with the state facing its own revenue problems, that went away. Brown says many communities have struggled ever since. She appreciates Mead's acknowledgement of communities.
If it's healthy at this level, then that creates vibrant economies, vibrant businesses, and that just rolls right on up through the state. If we're struggling here, then it's pretty hard for things to be much better in any other area.
The Cody mayor is especially pleased that the governor is helping out with operations, but she also worries about that money. Since it comes from the state, if the money were to be reduced, it would lead to serious budget cuts. So Brown says they must be smart.
I still think we'd be very, very conservative about how we use it for operations because you don't want to get dependent on it. We never have been. And because of that, we haven't had to do big layoffs when that money goes away. But I'm encouraged to see that he's at least acknowledging that operations are really running thin right now in most cities.
And in many counties. Park County Commissioner Lauren Grosskopf notes that his county just reduced budgets by 4%. He says it is possible that the new state money could offset those cuts, but that would first depend on the local economy. If it continues to lag, the new money would be welcome, but he's not sure how it would be used. He says it is dependent on their local revenue streams.
If all those remain the same, and this $500,000 or whatever it's going to be per year was extra money, that's entirely different than if our funding streams revenue went down and our costs went up. You know, the $500,000 might be enough to shore up, and so we wouldn't have to reduce spending again.
Evanston is another community that struggled with local revenue, and Mayor Joy Bell says that makes things tough.
Because we don't know consistently from year to year what a consistent funding source is, you have a real challenge in building anything new in the community or adding a position instead of taking positions away.
Mel says the governor's proposal would provide revenue to keep the community stable and not force the city council to cut back on some important services.
And when you start talking about having to cut services in a city like Evanston, what you start talking about is reducing the quality of life and the things that the people really like about living here.
Bell says Evanston's pay rate lags behind many communities in the state, and the funding will also help them raise some salaries. The legislature will have the ultimate say on the budget proposal. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
A new exhibit offers three painters' views of protected private lands in Jackson Hole. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer reports on the first-ever collaboration between the Jackson Hole Land Trust and artists, called View 22.
Landscape artists, by definition, paint landscapes. So painter Catherine Turner, one of the partners at the Trio Fine Art Gallery in Jackson, had the idea to celebrate her muse, some of the private land that's protected from any kind of development. She and the two other gallery owners spent the summer and fall painting on location.
Our hope was that art could serve as a way of bringing awareness to the value of these lands for our community.
The nonprofit Jackson Hole Land Trust works with landowners to put protective easements in place. So far, the tally is 20,000 acres of private land protected in Teton County alone. The View 22 exhibit, named for the views in County 22, features paintings from 19 properties, including the nearly 400-acre Jenkins Ranch. It's been in Mike Wardell's family for 75 years. The family started protecting the land from development in the 70s.
For being 10 minutes from the town square, it's sort of a pristine primeval place.
With old-growth forests, two streams, and all sorts of wildlife. On a misty fall day, elk kept Jennifer Hoffman company as she painted.
And this huge bull elk just started bugling, and it was so close to us. It was absolutely incredible. I could actually feel it vibrating in my chest when he bugled. It was just incredible.
Hoffman calls painting in nature a spiritual experience. Her Trio Fine Art colleague, Bill Sawchuk, says art can capture that sense of the land.
You can kind of refine it to its purest form. Why is this valuable? Why is this so appealing to look at?
The paintings give the viewer a glimpse of Jackson Hole vistas through the artist's eyes. For landowner Mike Wardell,
it intensifies the meaning of conservation to me and the beauty of the property. Puts it in a different light.
Lori Andrews is the executive director of the Jackson Hole Land Trust. She says the paintings make the organization's work more tangible to the public, since most people don't get to stroll around Harrison Ford's property, for instance.
Not everyone gets to touch it and feel it and see it every day, so this brings it into a closer view, if you would, for more people to be able to connect to it.
Andrews says the paintings are a validation of the trust's work.
The landowners also are feeling a sense of pride of, look what I did. Look at the gift in perpetuity I've given to this community.
View 22 is on display through December 21st at Trio Fine Art in Jackson. The paintings can also be seen online at triofineart.com. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Micah Schweitzer.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and other information, you can all follow us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.